if they say it was the right decision, I'm not going to say they should be sued. I just disagree with the decision that they made. So in the interim, I would like it if people decided to grab a membership on my website, these 1,000 paid members we lost on Twitch. It's really a big hit. It really is a big hit. So I would love it if you came over to joinpacman.com, grabbed a membership there. And I'm going to keep people posted as to what is going on. One last thing. I would love it if you respectfully contacted Twitch and said something along the lines of, please unsuspend David Pacman. His coverage of the trial is a public service or whatever. Be polite, etc. I can't give you an email for who to contact. I've been told that in the past, when people have said email this email address at Twitch, Twitch considers that doxing because the person gave out an email. So I'm not going to tell you how to contact Twitch. Figure it out on your own, how to contact Twitch. It's not that difficult. And maybe lobby for our unsuspension. I would really appreciate that. I don't know what else we can do. We have a voicemail number. That number is 2192-DAVID-P. I want to be clear. This is satire. This is not really anti-vax content. But here is a caller telling me about some really weird vaccine side effects that he got. This is funny.
Hi, Dave. I was just watching your episode about the unhinged anti-vax woman, you know, at the school board, yeah, and her anti-Semitic rant. And I just want to go on record as saying I've had both the vaccine shots, both the Pfizer, early this summer, and I'm feeling great. Except maybe for picking up telepathic messages from the dark god Cthulhu, the ghost of H.P. Lovecraft. But that doesn't matter. I just put some tinfoil in my hat and I'm fine to go.
Exactly.
So just let everybody know there's no problem with the vaccine. It's working good. At least it is according to the ghost of H.P. Lovecraft.
Right. All right. Very good. Yeah, I'm going to be getting my third dose scheduled for later this week. I will report to you what symptoms I have. You know, it did happen that when I got my second dose, I did kind of trip on a curb and stub my toe on the way out. And so that, I don't know if I'm supposed to report that in the VAERS system, but it did take a couple days to heal and it sort of like chipped a little bit of my toenail. Okay, we've got a great bonus show for you today. We're going to talk about the right-wing hysteria over Big Bird and getting vaccinated. It's crazy. We will also talk about the Supreme Court, which will hear arguments on the FBI's surveillance of mosques. This is still a story. And we will talk about Philadelphia's ban on low-level traffic stops. What does that mean? What qualifies as low-level? All of those stories and much more on today's bonus show. Sign up and get instant access at...
Soon, pay toilets will take over the world, and everyone, everywhere will listen to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
The pose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hey, this is Marlon Saunders, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Hovland, you're listening to 88.3 WRCT FM, Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh.
Hello, this is Adam Clayton here, the bass player from U2. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Hi, this is Kristen Hirsch. You're listening to 88.3 FM, WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT Pittsburgh. We love monkeys.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all RDJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
O-U-R-C-T Radio 900.
Is Mark G of the Evolution Control Committee, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, where the drunken pants are going wild.
Hey, this is Jim from Rusted Root, and you're listening to WRCT 88.3 in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
WRCT is the best place to be. He sends the music out your way 40 hours every day.
This is Ziggy Marley, and you're listening to WRCT in Pittsburgh, you know? Go Steelers.
WRCT, Pittsburgh.
Yeah, that's where things like this go, right down the drain.
Hi, we are Microwaves, reminding you that the most important things in life are to crush your enemies,
to see them driven before you,
and to hear the lamentations of their women while listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
WRCT Pittsburgh, the last bastion of pulchritude.
It's been a long time since you've touched the hand and the heart of that special someone. You're not alone. This is WRCT Pittsburgh's Radio Automation Service. Stay tuned for more tracks from our radio and record library.
And Glasgow, this is Democracy Now!
What is 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature average? That is about 2 degrees plus for Africa and for many other places. So we'll mention that figure. It sounds something tolerable, that something that can be, you know, people can survive under it, but some people, is total sacrifice. It means you're actually sentencing people to death.
At the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow, a draft agreement has been released urging nations to increase their pledges to cut greenhouse gas emissions and phase out coal. But climate justice activists say the document falls far short of what's needed to avert a climate catastrophe. We'll speak to Nigerian environmental leader Nima Bassi, then look at the Global Climate Wall, a new report examining how the world's wealthiest nations are prioritizing borders over climate action. Plus, we speak to the famed Indian writer Amitabh Ghosh, author of the new book, The Nutmeg's Curse, Parables for a Planet in Crisis.
The climate crisis of today is rooted in centuries of geopolitical history that have created enormous disparities of power and wealth across the globe.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Glasgow, the UN Climate Agency released a draft accord today calling on countries to set more aggressive goals for cutting emissions and to fast-track the phasing out of coal as well as phasing out fossil fuel subsidies. The document also says countries should stop emitting greenhouse gases, quote, by or around mid-century, but does not set precise or urgent deadlines and enforcement policies. Negotiators at COP26 will continue talks over the second half of this week before a final deal is reached. This comes as the group Climate Action Tracker found the planet's on track to see a catastrophic 2.4 degrees Celsius rise in temperature this century, even with governments' pledges to reduce emissions. In other COP26 news, the foreign minister of Tuvalu recorded a speech to delegates delivered while standing knee-deep in seawater to highlight how the low-lying Pacific Island nation is facing imminent danger from rising sea levels.
We will not stand idly by as the water rises around us. We're not just talking in Tuvalu. We are mobilizing collective action at home, in our region, and on the international stage to secure our future. On the national level, we are pursuing bold legal avenues to ensure that Tuvalu's existing maritime boundaries will remain intact and we will be recognized as sovereign, even if our land territory is lost to climate change.
New York Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez arrived at the Glasgow summit, where she echoed House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's message there that America is back when it comes to the global fight against climate change. But Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez added the U.S. has, quote, not recovered our moral authority on climate action, and that the U.S. would have to prove itself by actually slashing its emissions.
We can't actually just pursue decarbonization. It has to center a benefit for the working class, for the vulnerable, for frontline communities, people of color, women, underserved communities. And it has to have a justice and jobs focus in order for us to meet our emissions goals.
We'll go to Glasgow for the latest after headlines. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., calls are mounting for congressional action against Republican Congressmember Paul Gosar after he posted an animated video on social media where he murders Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and attacks President Biden. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has called on House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy to request an investigation from the House Ethics Committee and law enforcement. Paul Gosar's own sister, Jennifer Gosar, called Gosar a sociopath and said his behavior could escalate. Pfizer Tuesday requested federal regulators authorize the COVID-19 booster for all adults. Currently, people 65 and older and adults at high risk due to medical conditions, living or working conditions, are eligible for the booster. The FDA is expected to grant Pfizer's request. A new study out of Texas shows unvaccinated patients are 40 times more likely to die of COVID-19 than fully vaccinated Texans. When numbers were studied during the Delta variant surge, the likelihood of death for unvaccinated people shrank but still remained exponentially higher at 20 times that of vaccinated Texans. In more vaccine news, Moderna's attempting to keep the names of government scientists off its coronavirus vaccine patent, which could have major implications in how the vaccine is distributed throughout the world. Three researchers from the National Institutes of Health worked with Moderna to develop the vaccine, which was also funded with $10 billion in public money. In Kenosha, Wisconsin, the prosecution rested its case in the murder trial of Kyle Rittenhouse. On Monday, a volunteer medic testified he feared for his life before the white 17-year-old opened fire with a semi-automatic assault rifle, striking his arm and blowing away most of his right bicep. Gage Grosskreutz recounted to jurors how he drew his own pistol after seeing the teen gunman fire several shots from his AR-15 during last summer's racial justice protests. He's being questioned here by Kenosha's Assistant District Attorney Thomas Binger.
I thought that the defendant was an active shooter.
What was going through your mind at this particular moment?
That I was going to die.
That was Gage Grosskreutz. Rittenhouse fatally shot two people that night, Anthony Huber and Joseph Rosenbaum. The defense will continue making its case today. Meanwhile, in Georgia, a Glynn County police detective testified Tuesday that Gregory McMichael, the former police officer and one of the three white men charged with hunting down and murdering Ahmaud Arbery, told him he never saw Arbery commit a crime. Another officer, Jeff Brandeberry, testified McMichael never said he was trying to perform a citizen's arrest of Arbery, which is a major part of the defense's arguments. He's questioned here by prosecutor Linda Dinikofsky.
While speaking with you, did Greg McMichael ever use the word burglary?
No, ma'am.
Did he ever use the word trespass?
No, ma'am.
Did he ever tell you, while you're talking to him, that he was attempting to make a citizen's arrest?
No, ma'am.
Did he ever even use the word arrest?
No, ma'am.
Did he ever even use the word detain?
No, ma'am.
All right. Did he ever tell you that, oh, we were going to detain this guy and wait for the police to come and investigate?
No, ma'am.
In international news, in Ethiopia, the United Nations says 16 staffers have been detained in the capital Addis Ababa. At least six others have been released. It's unknown why they were apprehended. This comes as the UN warns Ethiopia could descend into a full-scale civil war as violence intensifies between the Ethiopian military and Tigrayan rebel forces after 1 year of conflict. The agency estimates over 7 million people urgently need humanitarian aid in northern Ethiopia alone, with some 400,000 people in Tigray already living in famine-like conditions. The UN says it's still not able to access those in need in Tigray. In Niger, at least 25 children were killed and over a dozen injured when a fire engulfed their classrooms Monday. Fires are not uncommon in schools in Niger, which are often constructed from flammable materials like straw and wood. It's the latest tragedy in the West African nation. Just one day earlier, at least 18 people died in a collapsed gold mine in the south of Niger. Separately, Niger had just held 2 days of national mourning after 69 people, including a local mayor, were killed last week in an attack by gunmen in Niger's volatile southern border region. The UN is urging Burma's military to give the agency access to over 3 million people in need of life-saving humanitarian aid amidst ongoing violence following the February 1st military coup, a growing economic crisis, and the COVID-19 pandemic. In other news from Burma, U.S. journalist Danny Fenster has been charged with terrorism and sedition. Fenster's been detained since May and is already on trial for three other charges, accused of instigating dissent against the military, visa breaches, and unlawful association with a, quote, illegal group. The 37-year-old is a former managing editor of Frontier Myanmar, an independent online news outlet. His trial is being held at a military-run court inside prison where members of the public, reporters, and embassy officials are banned from entry. In Yemen, a journalist has been killed in a car explosion in the city of Aden. Rasha Abdullah Al-Harazi worked for a United Arab Emirates-based television channel and was pregnant. An initial police investigation revealed an explosive device had been planted on her car. Her husband, who's also a journalist, was also in the car. He survived but was seriously injured. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack. A new investigation by a federal watchdog found at least 13 Trump officials engaged in illegal campaigning for his re-election while in office in violation of the Hatch Act. Some of those named in the report include his son-in-law and senior advisor Jared Kushner, Counselor Kellyanne Conway, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany, and senior advisor Stephen Miller. Meanwhile, the House committee investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection has issued subpoenas to 10 more former Trump officials, including Stephen Miller and McEnany. McEnany made multiple claims about voter fraud, both before and after the 2020 presidential election, including at her first news conference following Trump's loss to Joe Biden.
There are very real claims out there that the campaign is pursuing. This was a system that had never been tried in American history, mass mail-out voting. It's one that we have identified as being particularly prone to fraud.
This comes as a federal judge Tuesday rejected Trump's latest bid to use executive privilege to block the January 6th House committee from accessing documents related to his attempts to overturn the election. Judge Tanya Chutkan said, quote, "Presidents are not kings and Trump is not president." The National Archive is expected to release the documents beginning on Friday. And the Oklahoma Supreme Court has overturned a historic 2019 ruling against Johnson & Johnson, which ordered the company to pay $465 million for its role in fueling Oklahoma's opioid crisis. The court said the state's public nuisance law could not be applied to J&J's deceptive marketing practices. Oklahoma's attorney general indicated his office may seek to challenge the ruling. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, we begin today's show in Glasgow at the UN Climate Summit. Earlier today, a draft agreement was released calling on nations to strengthen their climate plans and to accelerate the phasing out of coal as well as subsidies for fossil fuels. The draft also urges wealthy nations to, quote, urgently scale up financial support for developing countries to help them adapt to the climate crisis. A key part of the draft calls on nations to make tougher pledges to cut emissions by the end of 2022, 3 years earlier than scheduled. Greenpeace issued a statement saying, quote, "This draft deal is not a plan to solve the climate crisis. It's an agreement that we'll all cross our fingers and hope for the best," they said. This comes as a new report by the group Climate Action Tracker estimates world temperatures are on track to rise by 2.4 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels based on current emissions pledges. That's far higher than the 1.5 degree goal set at the Paris talks. We now go inside the COP to Glasgow, where we're joined by the Nigerian environmental leader and poet Nimo Bassi. He's the director of the Health of Mother Earth Foundation and author of a number of books, including Oil Politics, Echoes of Ecological Wars, and To Cook a Continent, Destructive Extraction and Climate Crisis in Africa. Nimo Bassi, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you respond to the draft report? Where's the enforcement? And what about the goals that have been set in the midst of this climate emergency?
Thank you very much, Amy. It's very clear that this COP is going to end the same way other COPs have ended previously, with very little ambition, very little seriousness, and with a lack of focus on the fact that we are in a planetary emergency. For the first time, however, they're talking of phasing out some part of fossil fuel, but then they're choosing and picking. The whole world knows that the climate crisis we are facing today is being exacerbated by the burning of fossil fuel. So saying you should phase out coal and only phase out subsidies for fossil fuel means that this COP believes that fossil fuel use in energy production in whatever should continue. In other words, that the carbon budget is something that can be toyed with. So this is extremely disappointing. And the only hope we have is that this is a draft document, but the tendency is that the draft document may be further watered down so that final document may actually come out to say, don't phase out anything, just remove subsidies. But this is nothing that is binding, nothing that can be anybody can be held to account for. That is why, at the same time, we're seeing the kind of contributions and proposals made by government to cut emissions. They are not talking about net zero, net emission reduction. They are not talking about actual emission reduction. They are not talking about stopping emissions at source. They are talking about how to continue with business as usual while showing means and ways of capturing equivalents of the carbon they are emitting. And so the document itself shows clearly that those who are drafting it are drafting as if they're drafting for other people to implement. There's no force behind what is being proposed. For example, it expresses regret that industrialized rich nations are unable to raise the climate finance target of just a mere $100 billion. That is really, it's a disappointment, because it's not for lack of funds that this money is not being raised. The industrialized nations, they spend close to $2 trillion in military warfare every year. And so looking for $100 million shouldn't be a thing that they will scratch about and keep procrastinating or try to make it as loans to poor, vulnerable nations that are already being flooded, that are already facing serious climate impact. So I see the draft agreement, the draft pact, or whatever they may call it, draft decision, as an indication of lack of seriousness. And it's a big threat to those who are already on the front lines suffering impacts of global warming.
And Nimo Bassi, could you talk about the impact of all of the fossil fuel lobbyists that have been at this gathering? A global witness estimates that at least 503 fossil fuel lobbyists were granted access to COP26. Was it more of a carbon stock exchange than it was actually a meeting of the people of the world to figure out what to do about climate change?
Clearly, with the having so many fossil fuel company delegates at the COP is a clear indication that we can't really expect anything good from this COP. The fossil fuel industry have captured the COP over the years. They've been supporting the COP, sponsoring the COP, advertising the COP. This year, there's less of the advertisement, but they're all here. Over 500 delegates, far more than many countries' delegates put together. This overwhelming presence again validates the suspicion and the fact that the COP is not really serious about tackling global warming. And if they're not serious to tackle global warming, if they keep depending or listening to the fossil fuel industry, we don't see how they're going to do what needs to be done. And what needs to be done is to keep fossils in the ground and then rapidly move away from the civilization that's driven by petroleum resources and by coal and by gas. The presence of this group of people and the financial institutions backing them is really very disturbing and very troubling. Here we are today, we're hearing, the fossil fuel industry is planning to invest about $250 billion over the next one decade in Africa and about $1.4 trillion by the year 2050. All these don't paint a good picture for the future. It's like they're looking for profit for speculation today, and they don't just care what happens tomorrow.
And what about those who say that the very process, the structure of COP is dooms it to failure because you must have consensus of all of the nations rather than a majority rule? Consensus means minority rule because one or two nations can stop the process. How does this affect the majority of the nations of the world who may have different perspectives from the industrial, the giant industrial polluting nations?
Working on consensus rather than majority vote is one of the things that people see as beautiful about the COP process, about the entire United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change processes. But this concept of consensus was shattered in the COP at Cancun. At Cancun, at least one nation, which was Bolivia, stood up against the agreement, and they were just pushed aside, and then they went ahead to celebrate the adoption of the Cancun outcome. So consensus here has a peculiar meaning defined by those who are driving the COP, the presidents of the COP, and those who are organizing it. And it is not in the interest of the vulnerable nation. It's not about listening to those who are suffering grave impacts. Just imagine the fact that today the world is celebrating or accepting 1.5, the faulty Paris target, 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial level. And now estimates show that the national determined contributions would amount to about 2.4, 2.7 degrees Celsius temperature increase above pre-industrial level. What does that leave Africa? For Africa, that would mean at least more than 3 degrees Celsius temperature, and that means setting the continent on fire. It means just sacrificing the continent. And yet we believe that these things are tolerable. This is, I believe, criminal, to say the least.
Nima Bassi, the text doesn't mention the contentious Article 6 of the Paris Agreement, which would establish the rules of a global market for buying and selling carbon. Can you explain this in lay terms for people to understand your thoughts on that and where you think this is ending up?
Well, the issue of bringing carbon markets into the COP is also one of those issues that kind of pretends to push the idea, or to push in the idea that the market can solve a problem that has been created by the market. It's completely impossible. The market is all about profit, it's about power, it's about control, it's about domination, and this is not a way to build solidarity or cooperation between countries in the world today. And so we've got before, in terms of carbon market and so on and so forth, we had elements like carbon trading, like reducing emissions from deforestation and forest degradation. And now to make it sound better, to make it sound more acceptable, they talk about net zero. So pricing carbon is just about, is pricing hot air, that's what it means. It's just it's a device. It's a device for avoiding action. And so you could say, well, I could keep on polluting, then some trees we pay for a forest in the Congo or in Uganda or in somewhere in Amazon that is not already being burned down, and then you continue with pollution, continue consuming things at levels that are intolerable. So the whole carbon market mechanism is about avoiding action, avoiding climate action, but then profiting from the inaction and profiting from the misery of majority people in the world today.
And Nima, could you talk about two of two of the world's largest polluting nations are absent from the COP this year, China and Russia. Could you talk about China's role, especially in Africa, with its Belt and Road policies and also with its voracious desire for more minerals?
Sorry, could you repeat that?
I don't know if you heard me. I asked you about the absence of China and Russia from the COP this year and China's role in Africa in terms of the environmental harm.
Yes. Thank you. It's really very concerning that the big polluters such as Russia and China, the leaders, would actually stay away from the COP. It speaks very poorly of their leadership and of their concern about what is clearly a global problem. Many other leaders consider climate change as national warming rather than global warming, and that is why the Paris Agreement based its action on national determined contribution rather than globally, scientifically determined decisions about who would cut and to what level. Now, China is overrunning Africa, driving deforestation in the continent, investing in fossil fuel facilities development, exploitation pipelines, for example. They're investing in the pipeline that will take oil from very waxy oil from Uganda to a seaport in Tanzania for export. And this is something that is really threatening not just climate change, but the livelihoods of millions of Africans who live in the Rift Valley and who depend on freshwater system from the Lake Victoria Basin in East Africa. So right across the continent, the influence of China and the investment in fossil industry development on the continent is a big problem in terms of global warming, in terms of livelihoods, and in terms of local economies. Because right on that continent, I would say, the total workforce of the continent, less than a percentage, 1%, of Africans are working in that sector. So it doesn't in any way multiply or add up to the local economies. It's just another wave of exploitation, and that's what China is driving on the continent. Russia on its own is driving, pushing old technology for nuclear power in some places on the continent, and I believe that they ought to have been on the table. They should face the nations that they are in whose territory they are taking action that is compounding the crisis, and not stay away and just send delegates to come here and talk to the rest of the people.
Nemo, as we wrap up, number one, can you describe the real effects of the climate emergency on the continent of Africa? And two, what gives you hope? When we see you every year at the climate summits, we've been together from Copenhagen on. You've been arrested at protests. You keep going. What gives you hope?
The impacts of global warming on the continent of Africa is enormous. One thing is that Africa is right at the center of the world, have the large chunk of the continent right on the equator. So the temperature impact on the continent is far above the global average. So global averages personally are very threatening to me and to others on the continent. The continent is surrounded by water bodies. So this serious sea level rise impact is being predicted by the IPCC to have higher levels of impact, apart from the Pacific island states, on the continent. Already, a place like Nigeria is losing about 2 meters every year to coastal erosion due to sea level rise. And this is having grave impact already on communities, on infrastructure, and it's a big problem. Now, what gives me hope? I'm thinking that this may be, I've been on most COPs and we've met, and I really enjoyed, I appreciate the amount of influence and that you're helping to promote the right solutions from these COPs. But this may well be my last attendance at a COP if the process continues to go the wrong direction. The COP provides a very good opportunity for movements and civil society actors to meet outside. And right now, as you sit in the COP in Glasgow, there are very real, grounded discussions going on in the People's Summit outside of the COP. And I'm looking forward to a time when the outside will be the arena for decision-making, just as we find in Cochabamba, but this time enforceable decision-making, because the COP is more or less a playing ground for politicians.
We want to thank you so much, Nimmo Bassi, for being with us, Nigerian environmental activist and poet, director of Health of Mother Earth Foundation in Nigeria. In 2010, he won the Right Livelihood Award, author of a number of books, including Oil Politics, Echoes of Ecological Wars, and To Cook a Continent, Destructive Extraction and Climate Crisis in Africa. Coming up, we look at the global climate wall, a new report examining how the world's wealthiest nations are prioritizing borders over climate action. Stay with us. It's only 4 degrees, it's only 4 degrees. It's only 4 degrees, it's only 4 degrees. Here on Democracy Now! Climate Countdown. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. On Tuesday, a giant puppet called Little Amal, the Arabic word for hope, arrived at COP26 in Glasgow after walking some 8,000 miles across Europe to join an event highlighting gender equality. Little Amal represents a Syrian refugee girl. She was there to call attention to refugee children living on the front lines of the climate crisis, which is a driving force behind displacement and migration from sea level rise and drought to hurricanes, flash floods and fires. The world's richest countries have responded by militarizing their borders and treating the humanitarian crisis as a security issue. NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg attended this year's UN Climate Summit, marking the first time a top military alliance leader came to the climate talks since they began. On Tuesday, U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi traveled to the COP26, along with other Democratic lawmakers like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and raised the issue of security during a news conference. This is part of her exchange with Abby Martin of the Empire Files.
Speaker Pelosi, you just presided over a large increase in the Pentagon budget. This Pentagon budget is already massive. The Pentagon is a larger polluter than 140 countries combined. How can we seriously talk about net zero if there is this bipartisan consensus to constantly expand this large contributor to climate change?
National security advisors all tell us that the climate crisis is a national security matter. It is, of course, a health matter for our children, the water they drink, the air they breathe, et cetera. It is a jobs issue between clean technologies being the future of our workforce and the training for all of that. It is a national security issue because of the all of the conditions that climate crisis produces. I won't go into all of them, but they do are cause for migration, conflict over habitat and resources, and again, a security challenge globally. The Defense Department sees this systemically, that we have to stop it as a national security issue, and one way to do that is to stop our dependence on fossil fuels, which exacerbate the climate crisis. With that, I thank you all for being here. Unfortunately, they're telling us they have to clean the room.
So that's Nancy Pelosi at the COP, and you can see our extended discussion yesterday on the military and the climate emergency. Well, the press conference is over that Pelosi spoke at, but we continue the conversation now with two guests from Glasgow. Inside COP26 with the grassroots delegation It Takes Roots is Sandra Denis, executive director of the Miami Workers Center. And joining us outside, Nick Buxton with the transnational National Institute, co-author of their new report, Global Climate Wall, How the World's Wealthiest Nations Prioritize Borders Over Climate Action. Before we talk about specific countries like Haiti, Nick Buxton, talk about your findings, this prioritization of the militarization of borders over dealing with the climate emergency.
Well, I think it was interesting just hearing, thank you, Amy, for the invitation to be here. I think it was interesting we heard there that climate is being discussed by Nancy Pelosi, but it's not being discussed as an issue about how we address climate migration. There she described migration as a security threat. And that is the only way that climate and migration has been discussed at this summit. And that doesn't surprise me, because what we've looked at in our recent report was really, where's the money going? Because we know that money is one of the big conversations here. Are the richest countries going to deliver their promised $100 billion in climate finance, which is wholly inadequate, and yet they fail to deliver that? So we decided to compare what they have actually delivered in terms of climate finance with how much they're putting towards border and immigration enforcement. And what we found is that the richest countries are spending, these are the richest and the historical emitters of greenhouse gas emissions. We're talking about seven countries here, US, UK being some of the two big ones, are spending twice as much on border and immigration enforcement as they are on actually providing climate finance. So what we're seeing really is that the richest countries are building a climate wall against the consequences of climate change, rather than dealing with the causes and rather than providing the money that would enable people to both stay if they are affected by storms and extreme weather, or to leave and find safety if they are forced to travel away from their homes because they've been destroyed.
And Nick Buxton, how do these nations rationalize these policies, given the fact that international capitalism is constantly seeking to tear down national boundaries for the flow of goods, whether it's lower tariffs, whether for the free flow of money and investment? So how can they justify erecting walls against migrants while at the same time tearing down walls for capital?
Well, I think, I mean, that's really clearly part of this whole COP. And when we see it here, that really the whole, it's unfolding that the climate negotiations are really about how to provide business freedom. And at the same time, that depends on the control and the exploitation of labor. The border has become a front line for this. So if we are to have corporations moving freely, if oil is to continue to extract, no matter of the costs, then we are going to have consequences. And so those consequences be controlled. And of course, behind this is the whole industry. We've discovered that it's quite interesting that the biggest border security companies are also not only controlling the border, but they're also working with the oil firms to defend their assets. So what we really see here is that security, freedom of capital, and the chance to exploit and to make profits also depends on the control of borders and of vulnerable peoples. And there's a whole industry now that is profiting from the consequences of climate change, not just the oil industry, which, of course, has a business model which is based on wrecking the planet. But there's also now an increasing industry arising who can see that, who also benefit from more and more grave consequences, a military and a border security industry that is expected to be worth $65 billion. That's a gross underestimate. It's just part of the industry by 2025. But it's an industry that is really profiting from this climate crisis.
And how are some of the major fossil fuel companies, Chevron, Exxon, Mobil, are they also involved in border militarization?
They're not directly involved, but like I said, they contract the services of these border security companies. So, for example, ExxonMobil works with L3Harris. Now, L3Harris is one of the major U.S. border contractors that's involved on the border, the U.S.-Mexico border. Now, they also work with ExxonMobil to provide what's called maritime domain awareness, essentially controlling the area of the Niger Delta, where we know huge amounts of pollution have happened, and people, communities there have been fighting for a long time to both end the extraction that's destroying their life and that is destroying our planet. Now ExxonMobil is using a border security and an arms firm to do it. So there are very strong ties between these two industries. Another key example is BP is working with Palantir, and there's big campaigns in the US right now about Palantir because it's very much involved in ICE, in surveillance operations of migrants in the US. Well, it also provides real-time drilling data to BP. So these industries are very much tied, and they also share corporate executives. So we found that Chevron has the former CEO of both Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman on its board. So there's a lot of indirect ties. Like I said, they're both industries that can profit from a climate crisis.
Let's bring Sandra Denis into this conversation. Nick is outside the COP in Glasgow, though. And Sandra, you're inside the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow, just in front of that revolving globe. You're with the Miami Workers' Center. You're Haitian-American. I can't think of a country that is more affected by the climate right now. I'm wondering what words you have for the Biden administration. President Obama just gave a speech. President Biden last week. Nancy Pelosi just gave it. What message you have for the Biden administration about what should be happening when it comes to, would you describe Haitians as climate refugees and talk about what asylum seekers in Miami, where you're from, what they're fleeing?
Absolutely. And again, thank you for having me. For sure. Just a few months ago, we saw 17,000 Haitians and people, Black folks from Africa, in Texas at the U.S.-Mexico border, really being denied their human rights, not even given a chance, majority of them, to even ask for asylum, which is a right of theirs. And in turn, what we saw was, again, an increased, border patrol, folks really being rounded up, horses, and, you know, what we would say, whips. And that was the response when people from Haiti were fleeing the 2010, 2021 now earthquake that just happened. We've seen homes decimated, increased heat. We've seen folks lose all of their belongings in one day and, you know, having to flee their homes that they actually don't want to leave. And so when their environment that folks are living in actually is destroyed before them, they also are asking for countries such as the U.S., who one of the, you know, biggest countries that pollutes the earth, to be accountable. And that's not what we're seeing. And that's what we're hearing from folks in Miami, that they are not leaving their homes because they don't love their homes. But again, they're leaving because they don't recognize their homes anymore based on the climate disasters, earthquake after earthquake, hurricane storms, drought, their food sources being poisoned. So much has happened in the country. And those are the stories that on the ground that I definitely wanted to lift up.
And Sandra, you're on the inside of the COP as part of the It Takes Roots delegation. What are you focusing on in the meetings, and what's been the reaction of the national delegations or delegates that you've been able to talk to?
Absolutely. We are focused on real solutions. There's been a call for net zero. We know that is not the solution. We want real reductions, which equates to real solutions. And for us, that is growing the care economy, a low carbon industry where people who are on the front lines, overwhelmingly Miami Worker Center organizes domestic workers, folks who are our first responders. We believe that instead of investing in more border patrol, what we should be investing in is in the people in these industries that are low carbon, but also are the first folks to respond when there is a climate disaster. That's what we're lifting up. We'll continue to lift that up and really tell the stories of the folks who are on the front lines, who are the first impacted and worst impacted. This net zero that folks are talking about, doesn't work for us. 20, 30, 20, 40, you know, we don't have that much time because people from Haiti, people in Miami, people in coastal cities are experiencing the impact of climate change right now and have been experiencing it for quite some time now.
Sandra Denis, we want to thank you for being with us with the Miami Workers Center and the It Takes Roots delegation at the COP26 UN Climate Summit in Glasgow. Nick Buxton with Transnational Institute will link to your report, Global Climate Wall. Next up, we'll speak to the famed Indian writer Amitabh Ghosh, author of the new book, The Nutmeg's Curse, Parables for a Planet in Crisis. Stay with us. The universe wakes up by the comet is coming. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, Climate Countdown. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we end today's show with the prize-winning Indian writer Amitabh Ghosh, his new book is titled The Nutmeg's Curse, Parables for a Planet in Crisis. Ghosh writes about how the roots of the climate crisis date back to Western colonialism and the violent exploitation of human life and the natural environment. Amitabh Ghosh's previous books include The Great Derangement, Climate Change and the Unthinkable, and the novel Gun Island. He's joining us from his home in Brooklyn, New York. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. We last spoke to you at the beginning of COVID and how it was ravaging India. And here we are in the second week of the COP. Your book is getting rave reviews, The Nutmeg's Curse. Tell the story of the climate crisis through the nutmeg.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, Amy. Very nice to be on your show again. Well, you know, I really look upon the climate crisis as a process of violence, and it's a process of violence both against humans and against the Earth. And this process goes back, in my view, really to the 17th century, the 16th century, the European conquest of the Americas, and also the European conquest of large parts of Asia. So the story of the Nutmeg's Curse actually begins in a completely forgotten place, the Banda Islands, which are in the extreme east of Indonesia, a tiny archipelago. But this archipelago had an amazing tree, which was the nutmeg tree, which produces both nutmeg and mace. Anyway, to cut a long story short, the Europeans who entered the Indian Ocean went straight to the Banda Islands as quickly as they could, and they tried to impose monopolies on the nutmeg trade. But of course, the Banda Islanders resisted. But ultimately, what this led to was that in 1621, the Dutch East India Company actually implemented a final solution. They just eliminated the entire population of the islands. About 15,000 people, many of them were just killed, many of them were enslaved, the rest died of starvation and disease and so on. And of course, this was a story that was also unfolding on the other end of the English and Dutch empires, that is, in the northeastern United States. But
You know, in the case of the Banda Islands, what makes the story so poignant, in my view, is that, you know, at the heart of it is this tree, a sort of miraculous tree of life. And this tree became, which was a great blessing to the islanders for centuries, finally became a terrible curse. And that curse is, in fact, an instance of the resource curse. And that is what we see now unfolding around the world, all around us. It was so interesting to hear Nimmo Bassi talking about, let's say, Nigeria and how the deltas there are becoming really unlivable for people. Again, because of the resource curse of oil. We've seen so many countries just destroyed because of this resource curse. Iraq is a good example, so many other countries as well. So I think really what is happening today is that we are seeing a model which came into being in the 17th century, in this period, really the start of the so-called Enlightenment. And this model is now, it has been globalized on a planetary scale, and that it is literally sort of devouring our planet.
And Amitabh, I wanted to ask you specifically about that. You suggest in your book that the period of the Enlightenment led to a way of looking at Earth as the repository of resources made only for human use and consumption. But I wanted to ask you, even if we were able as a planet to shift from fossil fuels to renewable energy, wouldn't there still be the problem of this the overproduction of capitalism right now, that we'd have the problem then of having to deal with the e-waste of all the batteries for the electric cars and the constant changing of our batteries every year because the companies have to keep producing new models to keep the consumption flow going. So I'm wondering how you deal with this issue of the consumer society that capitalism so depends on now.
Well, that's a very good question. That's absolutely the case. You know, we seem to proceed on the understanding that energy produced by fossil fuels can just be easily replaced by renewables, and that's all there is to it, as it were. But that's not the case at all. Of course, even renewable energy requires inputs of so many other kinds of materials, rare earths for one thing, many kinds of minerals. But just think of even those windmills. I mean, they're just these enormous structures of concrete, and concrete is also the production of concrete produces a lot of greenhouse gases. But apart from that, you know, the thing about fossil fuels, the reason why they have become so deeply entrenched in our lives is not just because they produce energy, but it's because they produce a kind of energy that interacts with structures of power in very specific ways. So, for example, consider China. I mean, China is, of course, by now by far the leader in the production of renewable energy. But imagine if China were able to completely reduce its dependence on fossil fuels and switch to renewable energies. It would completely overturn the geopolitical order of the world today, because the geopolitics of the world really depends on the shipping of fossil fuels, you know, through these particular choke points. Two of the most important choke points are the Straits of Hormuz and the Straits of Malacca. And, you know, something like 40% of the world's oil is shipped through these choke points every day. So on controlling these choke points depends actually Western geopolitical dominance. And if fossil fuels were to be completely substituted at scale, what you would have is a complete inversion of the world's geopolitical order. And I think this is actually what we don't talk about when we go to these negotiations. Nimmo Bassi talked about militarization and so on. And I think what we are seeing around us silently unfolding around us is exactly this dynamic, this logic, you know, whereby the things that we don't speak about really are those that have come to control the planet and really have come to com- control our lives in so many ways. For example, it was interesting to hear Nancy Pelosi talk about, you know, making the military less dependent on fossil fuels. But in fact, you know, the U.S. military today really serves as the global protector of fossil fuel movements. So, you know, in a sense, the entire security structure of the world has become completely dependent upon the movements and flows of fossil fuels. So I think these are the unpredictable things that we simply can't are unable to acknowledge, as it were. But they need to be acknowledged. Otherwise, you know, these negotiations become really just the kind of sham that, in fact, Nimmo was describing.
Amitav Ghosh, I want to do a live little correct here. If you could come a little closer to the computer and hold the mic a little closer to your mouth, it'll be easier to hear you. But I wanted to read you a little bit from The Guardian, speaking at the World Leaders Summit at the UN in Glasgow. The Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi made 5 key pledges for how India would decarbonize over the next few decades. India, a developing country of more than 1.3 billion people, is the world's third largest emitter of carbon dioxide, after the U.S. and China, the last remaining major economy that held out on a net zero commitment. He now says he'll get to it by, I think it's around 2070. Your thoughts on the rule of Narendra Modi and what it means, for example, not to commit when it comes to use of energy to ending coal?
Well, Amy, can you hear me better now?
Yes, and a little better.
Yes. Well, look, let's just admit straight away that these net zero commitments are a kind of farce in any case. I mean, people are just pulling these numbers out of their heads. And a large part of this is simply because around the world today, leaders have become experts at greenwashing. They talk this language of greenwashing. And around the world, you know, even the most benign-sounding people like Justin Trudeau, I mean, you know, they talk this greenwashing rhetoric, but at the same time, they're constantly licensing more and more fossil fuel exploration. And that is exactly what Narendra Modi is doing as well. You know, I mean, he's talking a sort of greenwashing talk. At the same time, they've licensed 55 new coal plants, you know, which are going to come up in India's forests. These coal mines are going to wreck the lives of hundreds of thousands of forest-dwelling Adivasis or indigenous peoples, perhaps millions of them. Fortunately, this year, at least some Adivasis from India were able to be present at COP26. They were able to actually articulate their positions and their points of view. But essentially what this Narendra Modi's government has done, and it's not just his government, even the Congress governments before that were doing the same thing, was they were opening all of India up to the most rapacious kinds of extractive industries. It's a terrible process to witness.
Amitav Ghosh, in your book, you also emphasize what you call radical empathy. Could you explain what that means and how that potentially could have an emancipatory effect on, with respect to climate crisis?
Well, as we were saying earlier, in going back to the Enlightenment, the 17th century, and so on, we get this this mechanistic vision of the earth as something that's dead, as something that really exists only to provide people, you know, powerful human beings with resources. And I think at bottom, we just have to move away from that, move away completely to a different way of envisioning the earth. You know, I am a writer, and I think stories play a very fundamental part in this. But I do think this can actually have an important political impact. I mean, if you look at the people who've resisted fossil fuel industries most effectively in America, they're indigenous peoples. I mean, I know that you and Amy have been covering the No DAPL movement for a very long time. And as you know, the ideas about the sacredness of the earth were very important to that movement. You know, it's not necessarily something that you or the press always emphasizes, but In fact, the longevity of that movement, the resilience of that movement, really depends on Native American ideas of the sacredness of the earth, of the vitality of the earth. And, you know, movements like that are now appearing all around the world. In fact, you could even say that India spearheaded some of these movements. We had a movement called the Chipko movement, when women hugged trees to prevent their being cut down. But, you know, one of the sort of really really positive things that I see in the world today is that even high courts and Supreme Courts are beginning to recognize these ideas. I mean, in New Zealand recently, there was a judgment from I think it was the Supreme Court, that recognized the personhood of a river. So I think these ideas are becoming more and more widespread, and I think they could lead to a sort of change of heart across the earth.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. Amitav Ghosh, award-winning Indian novelist and writer. His new book is just out. It's called The Nutmeg's Curse, Parables for a Planet in Crisis. And that does it for our show. His previous book, The Great Derangement. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, we'll speak to climate scientist Kevin Anderson and the writer George Monbiot. Democracy Now! Currently has job openings. Go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astu, Joe John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, and Adriano Contreras. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Rusted Root, and you're listening to WRCT 88.3 in Pittsburgh. Yow.
You know what? Grant and I and the rest of the Away With Words team have been sending out this podcast for 14 years now, and we still have so much more to talk about. We're just getting started. Your questions and stories are what keep this show going. We could never do it without you. We learned so much from you, and we're so grateful. We also depend on your financial support. Go to waywardradio.org/donate and help out the nonprofit that produces this show. Here's to lots more learning and laughter.
You're listening to Away with Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. Not that long ago, we were talking about indefinite hyperbolic numerals. You remember that conversation, Grant?
Right. 40, 11, zillions, jillions, and all those other approximate numbers.
Right, those indefinite approximate numbers. Well, a couple of weeks ago, I was visiting family in the mountains of North Carolina, and I heard another one that I really love and am going to adopt, which is Humpty 12.
Humpty 12. Maybe about a dozen, but maybe not a dozen, a little more, a little less.
Yeah. I went on vacation and I came back and there were Humpty 12 pieces of junk mail.
Sounds like a cousin of umpteen.
Yes, I think it probably is, but it just, I don't know, it's just something delicious to roll around on your tongue. And you know what? I was also looking around a little bit more, and you may be familiar with this one. You can also use the term telephone number or telephone numbers. Apparently, since the 1940s, if you were talking telephone numbers, you were talking about a really big number. So people would talk about that in terms of a large sum of money. You know, that house costs telephone numbers, or it could be applied to your time in prison. You know, he's doing telephone numbers.
I can imagine a time in the history of the world where most people didn't encounter a big number until they got a telephone number or saw one.
Yeah,
well, I gotta say, we have umpty 12 things to talk about on this show. And if you'd like to join us, here's our telephone number, 877-929-9673. You can also email us, words@waywardradio.org, and you can talk to us on Twitter at WAYWORD.
Hi there, you have a way with words.
Hey, Martha, how are you? My name's Bobby, and I'm from Mount Sterling, Kentucky.
Oh, excellent. Welcome to the show.
Here's my thing. I was born in Toledo, Ohio, and moved away from there when I was like 11. But while I was there, my brother, who is 10 years older than me, would often come in and say, hey, guys, what's the lowdown? And I would be like, what does that mean, the lowdown? You know, being a kid, I was like, I didn't understand. So I, later in life, I really never heard it in Kentucky, but often would go back and visit family in Ohio. And again, people would say, what's the lowdown? And I never really understood what it meant. I just always assumed it meant what's happening.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds about right. What's the lowdown? So just tell me about the situation.
Well, I can't really give you a situation. It was just like he would come in from being out and just, you know, the family would be all around and he'd come in and say, hey, guys, what's the lowdown?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, usually when people see that, they mean give me the skinny or the scoop or the details or tell me what I don't know.
Well, right? I never really understood the lowdown part. I kind of was like, is he talking about the bottom line?
The bottom line, because that's low down on the bill.
Mm-hmm. That's a good guess.
That's a good guess.
Well, thanks.